Hello there, and welcome to The Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fospero. This week's guest is the founder and chief executive of Tusk, one of the world's leading conservation charities. Charlie Mayhew, MBE, set up Tusk in 1990, at the height of the elephant poaching crisis, after an early career as a Lloyd's of London marine insurance broker. His Royal Highness, the Duke of Cambridge, is an active patron, and Charlie has travelled with Prince William and Prince Harry on many occasions. Tusk protects more than 40 species and is celebrating 30 years as a charity. One of its most recent extraordinary events has been the Wildlife Ranger Challenge, which took place across 20 African countries, raising money to help rangers resume their vital work protecting vulnerable wildlife and ecosystems. More on that a little bit later. Charlie, thanks very much for joining me today. It's very nice to meet you at last, as I've heard such a lot about you and your work.
Well, that's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you, Helen.
I'm fascinated to really dig into your story a bit. How did you fall in love with Africa in the first place?
I was lucky enough to have an aunt and uncle who lived in Africa. And although we didn't really see them very often when we were young, when they did come back to the home country, as it were, they would have these incredible stories, romantic stories of the African bush that really caught me. And so when I had an opportunity to travel, having left school, I took the opportunity to go straight to Africa. And at that point, it was done in South Africa. It's not what I call the real Africa, but it was an entree to the continent. And it was enough to sort of really get me going and wanting to really explore more of the continent.
What were you doing out there when you first went?
Well, it was nothing to do with conservation or wildlife. I was actually a traveling salesman selling Bic barrows and stationery in this sort of the industrial estates of Johannesburg. But during the weekends, I used to be able to get out into the countryside and go and see my aunt and uncle who lived in Natal and out to places like the Kruger National Park. And so that was really the moment where I started to sense, you know, what the African bush was like.
I can't believe that I've got to this grand old age and I've never been to Africa or proper Africa, if you like. I've never seen any of the big five in the wild or anything like that. What are your earliest memories, the first time you saw, you know, giraffe or elephants in the wild? What was that like?
I was completely in awe of the great sort of megafauna, like, as you say, giraffe and elephant and rhino and lion, to see them in their natural habitat, completely free-ranging, free-roaming, is a real privilege. And it's something, obviously, over the years, you know, I've had a lot of opportunity to do. And it's I'm still mesmerized by some of these species. And, you know, to get up close and personal with an elephant or a rhino or a lion is always incredibly exciting.
I was going to say to you, actually, I would imagine that magic never goes away, because every time you see animals in the wild, it's always different, isn't it? And you never quite know what you're going to get and what to expect.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I always sort of say that when I'm, you know, in the bush in Africa, particularly if I'm on foot as opposed to in a vehicle, it's the one time when I feel really alive, because you just don't know what's going to happen. And there's always a sort of slight element of risk, I suppose, and danger, but it's very exciting.
After 30 years doing what you've done at Tusk, it's very cruel of me probably to ask for a few favourite moments, but there must be one or two absolutely favourite moments with animals that you will take with you for the rest of your life. What really stands out as those precious times?
Yeah, I've been so fortunate having traveled out there and right across the continent. And, you know, and I think until you go to Africa, you just don't get the sense of how vast that continent is and how diverse it is. But for me, very special moments being with mountain gorillas in Rwanda, being as close as you and I are now, socially distanced, I should hasten to add. But, you know, that is always, I think, for anybody who's had the experience of seeing mountain gorillas, is a remarkable experience, because unlike pretty well any other species, you can look a gorilla in the eye, which you're not meant to do initially, by the way, until they get comfortable with you. But when you look one in the eye, it's like looking at another human, in the sense you can, how you can read a human's eyes. So you get a sense of what they're thinking. And that to me was an incredible experience.
Are you supposed to look down when you first meet them and sort of away from their eye line?
Yeah, you're meant to be sort of slightly submissive, if really, I suppose. Yes, exactly. Sort of just, you know, looking away from them and
Is this in Bwindi?
I've been to Bwindi, absolutely, which is on the Ugandan side of the Murrington gorilla habitat, but also into the Volcanoes National Park in Rwanda. And I've been lucky enough to actually also see gorillas in the Congo as well. So it's always a very special moment to be close with gorillas.
But you started out at Lloyd's of London, didn't you?
I did. I guess like a lot of young people, I came back from a gap year and I wasn't really too sure what I wanted to do. And I sort of fell into Lloyd's. I took up a sort of graduate recruitment scheme with Willis Faber, Lloyd's Insurance Broking House, and joined their marine insurance department as a broker. And I did that for about 4 years. Great fun. It gave me a fantastic insight into the city and the financial world, which has actually paid real dividends for me subsequently as I've sort of built up Tusk. But I always had this calling back to Africa. And so I came up with a sort of harebrained scheme to take an expedition across Africa. And I rather cheekily went to the chairman of Willis Faber. And I have to admit now that I told a bit of a white lie because I said that I'd been invited to lead this expedition. In reality, it'd be my idea.
You'd invited yourself.
I'd invited myself.
I don't think it was a white lie. I think that was fine.
I'm glad you agree. Anyway, I said I thought it was an experience I had to, you know, take up. And would he sponsor me and allow me to leave to go and do this expedition? And Willis Faber were fantastic and they did exactly that.
And was it that expedition, which I think was actually part of a Channel 4 documentary, wasn't it, that really sealed your love with Africa and made you realise that your calling perhaps wasn't at Lloyd's of London, but in a different field?
Yes, absolutely right. So the expedition, in a way, to all intents and purposes, was a bit of a jolly, but I brought together 33 young people from all over Europe. So on a big blind date, basically, and they were aged between sort of 20 and 25, and from all walks of life. So the idea was it would be a sort of melting pot of young people from Europe to come together and to experience Africa. But to try and give it some sort of credibility, we took on various projects as we drove. It took 7 months to drive down across the continent. And we took on various projects, and a couple of those projects were conservation related. And so that was really the key moment that sort of set me on the path that I'm on now.
I think you've been quoted as saying that when you set up Tusk in 1990, it was a bit of a hobby to start with. It's been a very interesting and long hobby, hasn't it? How was Tusk actually born?
So this is a slightly weird story in that I came back from having made that Channel 4 documentary on the expedition, and a great friend of mine who's an actor, Tim Aykroyd, who is what you might describe an armchair conservationist. He's sort of terrified of the thought of going to Africa, but loves watching the sort of David Attenborough documentaries. And one evening we were together and, you know, he said, you must go back to Africa and make a film about the ivory trade, because at that time in the late 80s, we were losing something like 100,000 elephants a year to poaching for the ivory trade. So as we sort of steadily got sort of more and more drunk together that evening, I said, well, look, rather than going to a documentary, I think, you know, you're an actor and you're constantly looking for parts. Why don't we instead create a drama based on the ivory trade? And that way we can, instead of preaching to the converted through documentary, we can hopefully reach a much bigger audience. And so the idea was born that we were going to make this film and then the profits from the film would then go back into conservation. So that's why we set up Tusk, to receive the profits from this film. But we were extraordinarily naive about how you go about making a film. But to cut a very long story short, we did eventually make a film called Lost in Africa and raised about £3.5 million to make it. It was great fun making it, but sadly, like a lot of film projects, it didn't make any money. So there were no profits to roll back into Tusk as it stood.
So how did Tusk then eventually take off? It sounds like it was perhaps a slow process, was it?
Yeah, so we had the charity set up when the film was being made. And when it became evident that we weren't going to make any money out of it, I sort of thought, okay, well, we better start fundraising in a more traditional manner. By that stage, I'd gone back into financial services and had my own business. And so Tusk sort of rode on the back of that, I was just moonlighting, and had a few friends and mates. And once or twice a year, we'd organize some sort of party or go-karting event or whatever it was to raise a bit of money. And it was just our way of putting something back. But I never imagined that it was going to slowly but surely take over my life.
So what was the point where, I suppose, what was the crossroads where you went from it sort of being in the background and something you did a couple of times a year to you realizing actually this could be a day-to-day job and, you could actually do it full time?
So it did slowly start to take over my life. And when I used to go into the office in the morning, the realization was when I would come in and sit down at my desk and there'll be a pile of paper on my left, which would be the sort of the financial stuff and that I was meant to be doing with my clients. And then on the right would be all the African stuff, which was the conservation stuff. And I was always just being drawn to the pile of African papers. And so I just, decided that there was time to concentrate on the charity. But also we were lucky enough to be chosen by the Daily Telegraph as one of their Christmas charities. And that made a huge difference because it also coincided with when Prince William was on his gap year, and he became aware of Tusk at that point. And so that started the process of him taking us on as a patronage, one of his first two charities. And when that happened, I thought, goodness, right, okay, now it's got to be quite serious. And so that was the point I said, okay, I'm going to give up my commercial life and just focus on the charity.
We'll talk a bit, if we may, about Prince William later, because I know he's still very, very active for you. And I had no idea, actually, he's been involved for so long. I mean, that really is a fairly major turning point, I would imagine, in a charity like yours. But sum up a little bit, if you can, of the work that Tusk does now and the sorts of projects that you're involved in and the things, really, the highlights that you've done over the last 30 years.
So the ethos of, right from word go was a recognition that conservation is ultimately about people. And so for us, engaging local communities in the conservation work that we want to fund and allowing them the ability to derive real benefits from preserving their natural heritage and the wildlife that they coexist with is absolutely at the heart of what we do. And to just give you a little bit of context, a country like Kenya, probably 70% of its wildlife lives outside national parks. So the future of that wildlife is totally dependent on the relationship with the communities that live alongside it. As Africa's human population is rapidly growing, it's actually set to double from 1.2 billion today to 2.4 billion by 2050. So in the next 30 years, the pressure on land and habitat, forests and savanna, is just going to grow. So it is crucial, this relationship between humans and wildlife. So for us, we've built a portfolio of projects that we invest in and partner with right across the continent. And it's not just about tusked animals. We support anything from gorilla conservation, turtle conservation, all sorts of species under threat that we seek to improve their survival. But communities are absolutely the heart of that.
How receptive on the whole are those communities when you come in and you try and find a way of working together to protect the wildlife and the habitat?
The key for us is that our sort of business model, if I can call it that, is that we look to identify and invest in what we feel are the best local conservation organizations, grassroots conservation organizations, and we get behind them. They are the ones implementing the projects. I don't have some huge staff running projects all over Africa. We provide that sort of interface between the projects and the donor community. So, for us, the work that they're doing, engaging with these communities, has been fascinating to see it evolve over the last 30 years, where there is this growing recognition that actually conservation, wildlife, can provide real tangible benefits to these communities. And the best example of that is obviously ecotourism. And we've got projects, particularly up in northern Kenya, for instance, or in Namibia, where we've got communities of 5,000 people who are benefiting from one safari lodge or camp that has been put into their area, and they've adopted the principles of protecting the wildlife because they know that that brings in the tourist dollar and it brings employment and real benefits. And when you can demonstrate that sort of success, other communities literally sort of look over the proverbial fence, as it were, and say, gosh, that's interesting. You know, can we have some of that?
And what would you say are at the moment the main challenges that are facing Africa and its people?
For the last 5+ years, I think the world has been really focused on the impact of the illegal wildlife trade. Ivory trade, rhino horn trade, trade in pangolin, now lion parts, it's a big issue. And rightly so. And we've been trying to do a lot of work to get countries like China to, you know, change their approach to this and to introduce a ban in ivory and things like that. That's one major challenge, and it remains a challenge. But probably the biggest challenge coming down the track is loss of habitat because of the human footprint. And if we don't hold the front line, then that is the biggest worry, that we'll end up with small parcels of wildlife areas that aren't connected. And when you're talking about species like elephant that need to migrate over large distances, you've got to create those corridors and the space for them to be able to survive and exist. And ultimately, we need to ensure that we keep these wild areas for our own benefit and our own survival on this planet. You know, I think the one thing that we've been taught by this pandemic that we're going through at the moment is that we can't ignore how our own health and well-being is connected to the health of the natural world and the planet. And so, to my mind, saving habitat is critical.
I suppose as well as the human footprint, it's also climate change, isn't it, with the saving of the habitat.
And correct.
I love, as I'm sure you probably do, David Attenborough's wisdom and how, you know, in his mid-90s, he's still totally in tune with the crises that we face as a world. This was a quote from his documentary recently. He said, "The truth is the natural world is changing and we're totally dependent on that world. It provides our food, water and air. It's the most precious thing we have and we need to defend it." How optimistic are you, Charlie, that we can protect the natural world and pull it back from what feels like the brink to me?
I've always said that to be a conservationist, you've got to be an optimist, because if you look at the stats, the raw stats, it's not very encouraging. But I also draw a great deal of hope and optimism from a lot of the projects that I see that we're supporting across the continent, where we have managed to turn things around and we've managed to, as I say, persuade communities that there's real value in preserving their natural heritage and the environment around them. And, you know, that quote from David is absolutely bang on. And he gave a speech once at a Tusk Conservation Awards a few years ago, and I'll never forget it. You could hear a pin drop in that room. There were 400 people there, and he gave this extraordinary speech just off the cuff. Every breath of air that we take, every mouthful of food we take comes from the natural world, you know, and yet we are extraordinarily arrogant as a species that we think that we can just carry on, you know, destroying everything in our path. But ultimately, if we don't look after the natural world and we don't deal with climate change, then what hope is there?
You touched on the illegal trade in wildlife. I gather it's worth more than $20 billion a year or something absolutely crazy. And you also mentioned China. I know you went to China with the Duke of Cambridge, didn't you, when he spoke to President Xi. Was that quite a key moment? And did that help with legislation as far as China's concerned with the illegal trade in ivory?
To my mind, undoubtedly, the meeting that Prince William had with President Xi, I'm quite sure, was one of the major influencing factors to get China and President Xi himself, which was great because it came from the top, to introduce a domestic ban on the trade in ivory. And as a result of that, the price of ivory plummeted very significantly. Now, we haven't got rid of the trade completely, but it was a major step forward. And I think before that visit to China by Prince William, if you'd asked any conservationists at that time, you know, whether we could persuade China to change tack, I don't think any of us really thought that that was a realistic proposition. Now, Prince William would never, he's far too modest to claim that he was the one that changed President Xi's mind, but they did engage in a very, very good conversation on this. And there were other actors in the space, President Obama, who also Prince William had engaged with on it. And so I think, you know, slowly but surely, that pressure, you know, on China to think again and to introduce the ban definitely had an effect.
Having Prince William as your royal patron and having had him for so long, he's so passionate about conservation, must be absolutely fantastic. You've travelled with him a number of times. Can you tell us a little bit, give us a flavour of perhaps Namibia and Tanzania and the sort of things that you do and what he's like when you're on the road? Because he reminds me of my brother, actually. He just always seems terribly down to earth to me.
First thing is, he is very down to earth and he's great fun to be with. He's got a sort of mischievous sense of humour, but he knows precisely when to turn on the officialdom that, you know, when we've traveled to most recently to Tanzania and to Namibia, and he inevitably has to then go and do a certain amount of official meetings with presidents and things like that. And he's a complete pro at it. Those trips are extraordinary. There's a huge amount of work that goes into piecing them together. They are incredibly busy. Every sort of minute of the day is to have taken account of. And we always try and pack in as much as we possibly can. So there's no downtime. It is flat out for, you know, the last trip was a week. But the impact that it has on the countries that we're visiting, the projects that we're visiting, is huge. And the profile that he brings to not only the projects, but conservation in general and global conservation is of immense value.
Prince Charles, I remember, took William and Harry to places like Lewa in Kenya when they were little boys. How do you think those early trips perhaps influenced the young princes? Because they've always been very keen on conservation and very hands-on, haven't they?
Yes, undoubtedly. You know, I think Prince William has often said that those early trips to Africa, you know, had a big impact on him and consequently led him to wanting to spend part of his gap year, which he did in Kenya at Lewa. And you know, he's developed a real passion and a love of the continent, its people and its wildlife. And he cares very deeply about it. Africa is one of those places, anyone who's been to Africa, I think, will understand what I'm saying. It has this ability to get under your skin and in your blood. And, you know, certainly from my perspective, I sort of start to go through withdrawal symptoms if I haven't had a shot of African whatever after a few months. I have a real sense of coming home to Africa when I land on African soil, and it's very powerful.
There are a lot of pictures on the internet of Tusk events with Prince William and Kate often by his side, the Duchess of Cambridge. Again, is she very passionate and very caring about the conservation side and very supportive of the work that Tusk are doing?
She's a very lovely person, and has been very supportive of William in his role as patron of Tusk. And, you know, it's always a huge honour and privilege if she is able to come and join him at events. And she's always taken a deep interest in particularly the Tusk Conservation Awards, actually, is the one they both really enjoy meeting. The finalists that we normally bring to London, not this year, but that's always been a special event for them.
I've heard that Lewa is quite a special place, and it's done very well with the black rhino, hasn't it?
Yes, Lewa is a superbly run conservancy. To our mind, it's really a flagship conservation area that is always at the cutting edge of everything that's going on in Africa and in the conservation world. And we host an annual marathon at Lewa. This year it had to become a virtual marathon, but we run this marathon within the reserve. So it's a unique experience of being able to run wild, and you are running in a reserve, whether elephant, rhino, lion. You know, obviously we ensure people's safety, but it's
not running from the elephants or run fast.
We've had a couple of moments where a rhino has crossed the course and we've had to just stop the runners briefly to let the rhino pass. But it's an extraordinary event, and it's one of our big fundraisers of the year.
And the fundraiser I mentioned in the introduction, the Ranger Challenge that you've just done now. I mean, tell us a bit about that. The film clip I looked at on your social media, I mean, it looked quite a special event.
So the background to this was that as the world went into lockdown from the COVID-19, the impact on Africa has been huge. Ironically, the virus itself has not really taken hold in anything like the sense that it has in Europe or America and the Far East. But the economic impact on Africa has been absolutely devastating. And the way it's impacted is that because all the tourism and the travel industry has collapsed, that industry has traditionally underpinned a lot of the conservation work through the revenue that is generated from park fees, national park fees and things like that. So we very quickly realized that rangers, wildlife rangers, who are clearly on the front line of this work and working day and night and often putting their lives in danger, a lot of them were either being made redundant or were having their salaries cut, you know, by up to 80%. So we launched the Wildlife Ranger Challenge as a means to support rangers and to try and restore their salaries and their earnings and their livelihoods, but to get them back into the field and to make sure that as a result of the pandemic that we weren't going to see a significant upsurge in poaching. And so we ended up with getting over 2,000 rangers taking part in a virtual half marathon in their own areas. And we invited the public to sort of run in solidarity or walk in solidarity. We've had people cycling in solidarity with them. And we had this incredible donor, Mark Scheinberg, who put up a $5 million challenge grant. And he pledged that he would match dollar for dollar the amounts we raised up to $5 million. So by the end of this year, we hope to have, well, we will have basically raised and put back into the field something like $10 million geared towards getting those rangers back in the field.
That's absolutely extraordinary. And this whole event was across 20 African countries. It was huge, wasn't it?
It was. It was fantastic the way it galvanized the ranger movement. And they, you know, there was an incredible WhatsApp group that was going on where they were all sharing with each other across Africa. And it made them all really feel that they were part of a bigger movement. That was one of the sort of the feedback that we've had from these rangers, is that they really felt proud to be rangers and that the world was behind them. No, it's been a great success, and we are now looking to, you know, I think we've created a beast that we've now got to continue in some way. But the reality is that as a result of COVID, tourism is not going to bounce back very quickly. So for a lot of us in the conservation world, 2021 is a big worry. You know, we sort of muddled through this year, but next year is a real worry. So, you know, for us, I envisage that we will be doing another Wildlife Ranger Challenge next year.
It sounds like it's going to be an annual event, can I just say? It does sound
I think my team has been sort of taking a sharp intake of breath at the thought of that, because there was a huge amount of work that went into it, but it was a huge success and it's definitely paid off.
Where are we with the extinction crisis, Charlie? What wildlife are most at threat now?
I'm glad you've asked that, because I think people are familiar with the stories about the threat to elephant and rhino. But strange enough, one of the most iconic animals that we all grow up with in toys and in storybooks and whatever else is the African lion. The lion is now rarer than the rhino. There are less than 20,000 lions left in the wild in Africa today. And to put that in perspective, there are about 25,000 rhino. And we think that's pretty shocking. But 20,000 lion left. And the reason for that is that they've always been persecuted because of human-wildlife conflict. That issue of communities and farmers and livestock farmers and, you know, bumping into big cats is never a good result. So they've been persecuted on the one hand, and loss of habitat. And you'll now find them in less than perhaps 95% of their historic range. But the other big problem that has exacerbated is that there is now a growing trade in lion parts to the Far East. And so it has really put huge pressure on lion populations. Given the chance, lions will bounce back. But at the moment, it's not looking good. So the one thing that, you know, we are desperately trying to highlight is the plight of lions, because I think we've all been, you know, rightly distracted by the crash in the population of elephant and rhino and other species. But the lion is really in trouble.
Excuse my ignorance, Charlie, but what are these lion parts required for?
You might well ask. You know, lion bones, lion teeth, claws, skins, and they are used in all sorts of traditional Chinese medicine and stuff like that. And I think the belief is that perhaps because these consumers haven't been able to get tiger parts, which has long been a problem, that they've sort of turned their attention to lions.
What is it like when you're in the wild and you glimpse the lion for the first time? What's that feel like? She says desperate to get on a plane and actually go.
I think one of the things that when you see come across LAN on a game drive, preferably not on foot, you are immediately struck by the sheer power and strength of this animal. You know, if you look at the paw of a fully grown male LAN, it is a big animal. It's a very big animal. And they're mean killing machines, basically.
What can we do to help? I'm going to ask you in a minute how your celebrity ambassadors help, because your celebrity ambassadors reads like a who's who, quite frankly. But what about people listening? Can we make a difference? And can we make a difference here in the UK? Can we do something little that will contribute?
Well, you'd expect me to say yes, of course you can, by donating, because for an organization like us, we desperately need money in order to maintain these projects on the ground. But the other thing is that, you know, we have now, we're in the process of introducing an ivory trade ban in this country, which is at last, and is good news. But people, you know, when they travel, particularly if they were to travel, say, to the Far East or anywhere, you know, just be very mindful of that. Don't be hoodwinked into buying an artifact or a, you know, which is potentially made of ivory or has been passed off as being some form of bone that is legal. Just be really careful in that respect, because, you know, it's very easy for us to inadvertently encourage, if you like, the trade in these parts. And it's not just animal parts. It's also, you know, rare woods and things like that. You know, we've got to be much more discerning in what we consume and how we consume things.
I touched on there your celebrity ambassadors, Bear Grylls, Roy Bremner, Catherine Jenkins, to name but a few. But Ronnie Wood from the Rolling Stones was your first. How did Ronnie get involved? I'm very, very fond of Mr. Wood.
Ronnie is fantastic. I touched on it very briefly that when I came back from my expedition, I was involved in financial services, and Ronnie was a client
was
at
he?
That time. So that's how I got to know him. And he asked me to organize a safari, to take the family on safari. And so that's really how that started. And he was, as you say, the first celebrity patron that we managed to persuade to come on board. And he has been fantastic. You know, he loves Africa. He's a brilliant artist, as you probably know. And he did a series of wildlife art prints for us. He designed a t-shirt which we sold through Topshop. More recently, we had this rhino sculpture trail, big rhino sculpture trails that we positioned around London a couple of years ago. And Ronnie decorated one of those, which sat in Carnaby Street. And we then subsequently sold those sculptures, and his raised £100,000. And he came to the sale at Christie's. And, you know, he was so generous that we were sitting in the front row, and he just nudged me. And he said, at that price, I'll do another one. And so the underbridder also got one. So we made £200,000 out of him painting a couple of rhino sculptures. He's great fun.
Have you traveled in Africa with him?
Yeah, a long time ago, some time ago now. But yes, I did a couple of trips with him, and he was great fun. Always with a little sketchbook and just drawing and sketching portraits or anything he saw.
And he and a bit of noodling on the guitar on the campfire, maybe?
No, we never got that, sadly. But he's good fun.
So let's end, Charlie, with hopes for the future, hopes for Tusk, and hopes for Africa. That's three big questions all rolled into one.
Goodness, my big hope is that with what we're going through now with the pandemic, that the world really wakes up to the severity of the situation in terms of climate change and the environment and the natural world, and that we have to seriously mobilize. We have to push much higher up the agenda the value of the natural world for our own well-being and survival. And with that, Africa is one of the last great places on earth where you can see some extraordinary wildlife and areas, and we have to look after it. It is just so important to my mind.
Charlie, it really is lovely to meet you today and to hear about some of the fantastic work you're doing. Long may it continue, and here's to the next 30 years of Tusk and saving the lion too.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Charlie Mayhew, MBE, CEO and founder of conservation charity Tusk. If you want to keep up to date with the amazing work that Tusk is doing, give them a follow on socials at tusk_org. Thanks very much for your company. I hope you've enjoyed Charlie's chat as much as I have. You can download our library of podcasts at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, and on iTunes. I'll be back next week. Bye for now.